Recording progress.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to our IHCA all-member provider update call for January 11th, 2022. This is an all-member call because it's a lot of the new guidance that came out towards the end of December here. We wanted to make sure that everyone had some shared facts and information regarding all the changes that came out. Without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Brenda, who is going to go into some of the case counts and trends at this time. Thanks.
Thanks, Brandon. And again, good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. I know you are all very, very busy in your daily routines and operations, trying to stay afloat. And we're well aware of some of the challenges that you guys are facing. We're going to talk about some of those here today, and give you some guidance on what may be in our near future and some action items to take away. So we're going to start by looking at a couple of maps that show case counts. I'm going to have Brandon bring those up on the screen if you could, Brandon. The first, and I apologize for those of you that are not SNF providers. This is all, of course, SNF information because it's really all that we have to go on. And I'm going to preface all of this by saying, you know, this information is from 2 weeks ago. So quite frankly, has changed quite tremendously since these numbers were published. So the first map that you see here is a cumulative confirmed cases and SNFs by state. And you can see where Iowa sits in relation to the rest of the nation in terms of case counts over the course of the pandemic. Next slide, Brandon. Thank you. And then this is a percentage of new COVID cases in SNFs by state. So you can see that Iowa is not necessarily one of the hot spots, but you can see where it is moving across the country toward us. And certainly I know that you are all experiencing in some way, shape or form positive cases. I've heard from many of you about what is happening in your operations with these Omicron cases, coming up positive, sometimes very much to your surprise, because most folks are either asymptomatic or mildly symptomatic and you just weren't expecting it. Also, many of them are vaccinated, some of them even boosted. You can kind of see in a percentage there how that increased in the state of Iowa over the course of that week. So next slide, Brandon. And then this is just a count of the increase in COVID cases that particular week. So you can see that Iowa is in a dark pink there. So certainly our case counts are moving up. So if we look back over the course of the last month, the first Omicron case was found in Iowa on December 9th, which honestly seems like forever ago, based on all of the things that have happened in our state over the course of the last month. And if you've been watching the trend counts, you will see that the case counts have exponentially grown over the course of the last 4 weeks. If you look at the Iowa COVID-19 dashboard, you will see a line that goes almost directly up. And I am very well aware, and our staff is aware of how that is impacting all of your operations. So we're very mindful of how painful this might be. The good news is that some physicians at the University of Iowa expect for these case counts to reach their peak by the end of the month. So although this is very painful at the time, we believe that, you know, based on the data from other nations and other states that have been through this ahead of us, that this will be fairly short-lived. And so we do anticipate that those peaks will come in the next couple of weeks. The other piece of good news is that most of the cases that we have heard about or that are being found are, like I said, asymptomatic or very mildly symptomatic. The number of deaths in particular is very low, not saying that has not occurred, but it certainly does not appear to be the threat like it was at the beginning of the pandemic. The other piece of good news is that there's been some research that says, you know, this Omicron spread and surge may, in fact, be the gateway out of this pandemic. So I am hopeful that is true information. But what they're saying is that the spread of this Omicron is going to create herd immunity across our population. So we're hopeful that that is true. Certainly much more to be seen on how that may play out. But that is the good news for today. So the first thing we want to talk about, and I know that this is on everyone's mind because you all have been scrambling and diligently trying to get all of your ducks in a row for these mandates to be in effect. And so I'm going to give an overview of where we are in these very, very windy patterns of both of these mandates. So I'm actually going to start by talking about the OSHA vaccine and testing ETS that was released back in November. And so this mandate particularly has taken a windy path from being not in effect to in effect to not in effect. And so this is where we are today. So I'm going to start by saying, kind of illustrating how this plays out in Iowa. So Iowa, the OSHA office in Iowa determined many years ago that they were going to be what they call a state plan state. What that means is the state of Iowa then gets to reserves the right to create their own plan. And as long as it is meeting the expectations of the federal OSHA requirements, Iowa is allowed to determine how they're going to do that. And as long as it is as minimally meets the requirements of the federal requirements or more, then Iowa is allowed to do that. So in the weekend or over the weekend in the news, you may have heard how this is going to play out in Iowa. So the labor commissioner, Rod Roberts, made the announcement on Friday that he has decided after his review that what Iowa has in place is equally effective or as effective as it needs to be to meet the requirements of the national OSHA vaccine and testing mandate. Therefore, they are not going to adopt the OSHA ETS vaccine and testing verbiage into the Iowa plan. So they will not be enforcing the components of that particular ETS in Iowa. So I think that probably comes as a great relief to some of our providers who fell under that OSHA vaccine and test rule, specifically our assisted living folks who are not subject to the CMS mandate. I also asked the question if there was, and I just because I'm familiar with state and federal surveyors, if there was a risk that federal surveyors from OSHA would come to Iowa. And what I was told was no, that because Iowa is a state plan, we do our own enforcement. So to recap, at the current time, the OSHA ETS vaccine and testing rule is not enforceable and does not apply to Iowa. So the question then is, could that potentially change? So the answer is yes, that could potentially change if the federal OSHA office decides to take issue with what Iowa has done. But that certainly is in the future, and we can't speculate on what that may look like or even if that will occur. So at this point in time, the OSHA ETS is more or less dead in Iowa. So let's talk a little bit now about the CMS healthcare vaccination interim final rule. So for those of you that have been following this also very windy path, the CMS interim final rule for vaccination is not in effect in Iowa because of Iowa's involvement in that litigation case in the district court in Missouri. So at this point in time, that particular rule is not in effect in Iowa. So the Supreme Court heard oral arguments on Friday on both the OSHA and the CMS vaccination mandates. They, to this point, have not issued a decision. So what will happen is when they issue a decision, one of two things will occur. Either the Supreme Court will say, yes, CMS can move forward with their requirement for healthcare personnel to be vaccinated and all of the components that were written into that final rule, interim final rule. Or they can say no, that CMS does not have the ability to enforce that rule. So we're waiting quite anxiously to find out what the Supreme Court will decide. And certainly this is our top priority to keep an eye on this. And as soon as we know something, as soon as we know anything, we will certainly alert you to that. So one thing that everyone needs to keep in mind is if the CMS interim final rule for vaccinations applies to your entity, whether you be, you know, you are in a nursing facility or a Medicare or Medicaid certified home health provider, we are not sure at this point if the Supreme Court does allow CMS to move forward with this rule, if they will change the deadlines. So our recommendation here at the association is for you to prepare for the worst and hope for the best. But the worst case scenario is that they will allow CMS to move forward with the deadlines that were written in the QSO. And the first of those comes very, very soon on January 27th. So just a couple of weeks away. In the invitation for today's call, there is a link to the vaccine guidance summary that we have prepared to help you all understand what is expected to be compliant with this particular rule. I would suggest you take a look at that. And certainly if you have any questions, we're always here to help. But most of you have already seen that document and are already preparing with your COVID-19 plans and your vaccination documentation tracking, and you know which of your folks are not vaccinated and likely have already started the exemption request forms, if that applies, or figuring out how you're going to handle those unvaccinated staff, whether you're, you know, not going to allow them to work for a time, maybe you're going to put them on a furlough, or maybe your organization has decided to end their employment. So at this point in time, again, the CMS interim final rule is not in effect in Iowa. We still await the Supreme Court's decision on that particular item. So I don't know about you guys, but I certainly have been watching very, very intently to see what they have to say. I'm not in a position to speculate on what I believe will happen or what I think will happen. I know what I want to happen, and I'm hopeful for that. But at this point in time, really, there's no way to determine what that might look like. As an aside, if anybody has any questions, please feel free to put them in the chat. I know that there are a lot of gray areas in as we move forward through this. So please feel free to shout those out in the chat and we'll get to those at the end of the call. But I'm hopeful that creates a clear picture of those two vaccination mandates and where we are. So with that, I'm going to turn it over briefly to Lori. She's going to talk a little bit about what the foundation actually has some really exciting news to talk about their vaccine education campaign.
Thanks, Brenda. As Brenda mentioned, you know, we know right now is an important time for you to try and get prepared come what may with these vaccine mandate rulings. I'm really excited today to I know vaccine education has been top of mind for all of you. You've been working very hard with your staff to educate them about the vaccine and encourage their adoption where possible. And I'm very excited today to be able to share a new resource with you to help you with those staff education efforts when it comes to the vaccine. This was all made possible by a grant the foundation received from the Iowa Department of Public Health this fall. We received a $249,000 grant to develop this vaccine education campaign solely with the goal to increase vaccine adoption among Iowa's long-term care workers. In developing this campaign, we based it on what we were seeing in the vaccination data, and we were finding that the demographic primarily lagging in adopting among your staff were females ages 20 to 30, and the primary concerns they expressed were potential impacts on fertility, impacts on nursing mothers, and the speed at which the vaccine was developed. This campaign we developed uses testimonials from vaccinated workers to address all those concerns head on. I'm excited to announce the campaign is launching this week. It currently includes two videos featuring testimonials from our Iowa long-term care workers who are in that target audience demographic. The first video we created featured Vani. She's a working mom who is an administrator at an Iowa care facility, and she was actually breastfeeding her newborn baby when she received the COVID vaccine. And the second video features Mara, who was a high school student when the pandemic broke out. And her mom worked in long-term care, and she decided she wanted to become a CNA to help with staffing shortages, and she shares her vaccine story as well. We're also in the process of working on a third video we hope to add to the campaign featuring another young mother. But in all these videos, these staff members share their stories about the research they did, why they decided to get vaccinated, all in the hopes of helping to encourage their peers to consider vaccination as well. These videos are being deployed this week through a comprehensive digital advertising strategy that we developed in partnership with a PR firm used by AHCA, who develops national advertising campaigns to help reach our target demographic. So we're including media that this audience uses most, everything from Google search ads to YouTube to Hulu and Facebook ads. All these ads drive the viewer to a microsite we created, which includes additional information about vaccination that they can use. We also have these videos available for you to use with your staff as well, so I would encourage you to take a few minutes to watch the videos and share them with your staff too. You can access the videos on our campaign website, which is Get Facts About the Vax. We included a link to this in the call email. You can also find the link on our COVID resources webpage. And if you have any questions about the campaign or need any assistance in accessing those videos to share, please give me a call. Thanks, Brenda.
Thanks, Lori. Okay, so we're going to dig into some pretty murky waters here, and we're going to talk about the CDC's updated return to work guidelines. And I'm going to just preface this entire conversation and say this is a really, really confusing piece of guidance, and I feel like there are quite a few things in this particular guidance that don't match up with things that we have been doing or have been informed of in the past. And so we're just going to kind of march through some of that stuff here today. Before we go there, I'm just going to remind you all that we did update our clinical guidance summary. There is a link to that at the bottom of your agenda. It's also available on our website. And all of this information is included. So if you ever need to refer to it to answer questions on what you need to do with your staff, in terms of if they've had an exposure or are infected, you can refer to that. But I'm going to do my best actually to walk through this with you. So Brandon, if you would please put the link to the return to work guidance in the chat for anyone that wants to have that link. This is the CDC's guidance on work restrictions. So you can find this at that link when he gets it there. Thank you so much. Okay, so this is divided into two different sections, one for healthcare workers who are experiencing a COVID infection, and the other part is for a healthcare provider or personnel with an exposure. So let's talk first about a person who has a COVID positive case. And so the first thing I want to draw your attention to is vaccination status does not make any difference on a return to work decision. What does make a difference is what your staffing levels are in your facility. And this particular guidance was built off the strategies to mitigate healthcare personnel shortages document or guidance by the CDC. And Brandon's also going to post a link in the chat to that particular guidance. And they kind of walk through what exactly those definitions mean. And so each of you should have those definitions defined in your internal policies or procedures and how you define that in your own particular organization. I know from my own experience that that may be very different from one facility to the next, just based on what your normal staffing expectations are, what your acuity level is, you know, the patients or residents, tenants that you care for, maybe the physical, you know, makeup of your particular, you know, physical plant, your building. So I would encourage you to go back and review how you define that in your policy or your procedure, your COVID-19 plan, wherever that is found, so that you can ensure that those particular policies will support your decisions moving forward. One other note that I want to make is I believe that a facility or a provider can go from conventional to contingency to crisis in a matter of maybe 2 phone calls. Or in a moment. And so you may want to make sure that you identify that this could be defined either in a department specific, you know, you could identify that a particular department is working in a different level of staffing than another, or maybe a different unit, or from shift to shift, or from moment to moment. So I'm going to talk about the conventional expectation, which is, you know, if everything is working as it normally would be, and the requirement for a person with a COVID infection would be 10 days before they can return to work, or 7 days with a negative test, so long as they remain asymptomatic, mildly symptomatic, and their symptoms are improving. So again, there are some allowances made if you are experiencing staffing struggles in your building, which, again, I have received numerous calls from our members. I know that this is happening in your buildings. So if you are in contingency, if you identify that you're in contingency staffing, those folks can return after 5 days with or without a test. So it's not required that you test them to return. And even if you do test them and they are positive, they still can return to work so long as their symptoms are improving or they have mild symptoms. Now, if you find yourself in a crisis staffing situation, there really are no work restrictions for that person to return to work. I do want to just highlight a few things that come from the CDC's guidance about if you are returning a person to work prior to the conventional recommendation, you'll want to do a couple of things. You may want to consider putting them in an N95 respirator while they're, you know, caring for their residents, patients, tenants, whatever it is that your organization serves, and that they are, you know, social distancing whenever they possibly can. You may also want to encourage whoever they're caring for to wear a mask if you're operating in those capacities. Additionally, if it's possible, if you have COVID positive residents, you may want to allow those folks to work only with them, or if you can also reassign them to a non-resident or patient facing work role. So that really is what it says about restrictions for work for a person who is positive. So exposures is where it gets a little bit crazier. And quite frankly, if I were the DON in a building, I would go to the CDC's guidance and I would print off this chart that they have in their guidance. And because honestly, you guys, I look at it, I've probably read it close to 10,000 times and I still have to look at it every day. And they break down their work restrictions for exposures on 2 categories of folks. So if you have an employee who is fully vaccinated and boosted, really there are no work restrictions for them after an exposure. Let me back up just a second and let's talk a little bit about the definition of an exposure. The definition of an exposure by the, per the CDC's guidance is having contact with a positive person for 15 minutes over a 24-hour period. There are also some nuances to that in terms of if the person that is positive was wearing a mask or not wearing a mask, or if the healthcare personnel was not wearing the appropriate PPE that may qualify that as a high risk exposure. So again, if your employee is fully vaccinated and boosted, no work restrictions. However, in conventional staffing patterns, they do request that there is a negative test on day two after exposure, and then again on one occasion during days 5 and 7. So let's talk a little bit about the rest of the population who is not fully vaccinated and boosted. So the conventional return to work after an exposure recommendation is 10 days or on 7 days with a negative test. If you're in contingency, you will want to test them on days 1, 2, 3, and again on one day between 5 and 7. If you're in crisis capacity staffing, there's no work restriction for a person who is exposed, even if they're unvaccinated. So the one thing that I find extremely confusing and probably the most incongruent with the prior recommendations is that anyone who has had a COVID-19 infection within the last 90 days also has to be tested or falls into this category of vaccinated, unvaccinated to return to work. So, prior to this, they had recommended that, we don't test those folks for 90 days. They were exempt. But for the return to work after an exposure, they are recommending that someone, even if they have been infected in the last 90 days, be, excluded from work for 7 days under a conventional strategy and maybe, 10 days and 7 days, they can return to work with a negative test. So I do want to highlight a question that has come up for our skilled nursing folks that are doing their routine testing of unvaccinated staff. That has not changed. So if you have a person who has been infected within the last 90 days, they are still exempt from the routine testing guidance. So you do not need to test them within 90 days after an infection unless they have a high risk exposure. So I know that there are a lot of questions about how to apply this in real life. And anytime you have a question, please shout them out. And I see the chat going a little bit crazy, so we'll get to some of those specific questions that you all may have. The one question that I knew was gonna come, and it came yesterday, was I had a person who was positive a month ago. They completed their isolation, they're back to work, they had an exposure. I tested them and they're positive, but they're asymptomatic and I'm not sure what to do. And so the answer is you have to follow what is recommended in this particular piece of guidance, and that is to keep them off of work for 10 days or 7 days. They can return with a negative test. Or if you're in contingency, they can return to work with negative tests on the days that are recommended. So again, I feel like this particular piece of guidance is confusing and does not match up with other things. I have spoken with IDPH and DIA on several occasions about, how to really apply this, because it seems to not match. And they have indicated, IDPH indicated to me that the CDC was going to update some of their guidance specific to healthcare personnel and residents last week, and we haven't seen that yet. So still waiting to see if there will be other changes that come along with this. And on that note with residents, I do also want to highlight for our skilled nursing folks, The recommended isolation for a resident who has a positive case is still 10 days, and 10 days with 24 hours without fever reducing medication and improved symptoms. So that has not changed to match up with this particular work restriction guidance for our healthcare personnel. So it gets very, very confusing. But I would recommend you take a look at the CDC's guidance and then also review the Iowa Healthcare's clinical guidance summary where this is outlined and call with questions. So I'm going to move on to the testing supply situation. And I know that particularly skilled nursing facilities that are or nursing homes are struggling to maintain testing supplies and assisted living. If you are following along with the requirements for nursing homes with, you know, doing your routine testing, and also our home health folks that are trying to test based on this work restriction rule, everyone is struggling to find supplies. For those of you that are subscribed to the Iowa Health Alert Network, and Brandon, if you'll put that email in the chat here, if you are not a subscriber to the Iowa Health Alert Network, I would encourage you to become one, and you can send an email to the email address that will be posted in the chat here momentarily to request that they include you on those emails. But last week we were notified from the state hygienic lab that testing supplies, antigen testing supplies specifically, were in very short supply, and that the state hygienic lab specifically was going to be out of testing supplies by the end of the week. Excuse me. So for those of you in a nursing facility those of you that have been receiving supplies from the federal government, from HHS, those will continue to come. We have not heard otherwise, but for those of you that were requesting antigen testing supplies from the state hygienic lab, those are no longer going to be available. So this creates a serious situation. And IHCA has been in pretty much constant contact with IDPH and DIA about how this affects operations for you all. And we're working through some of those kinks, and I unfortunately do not have a whole lot of answers to give you right now. But what I can tell you is I have a couple of recommendations on testing supply shortages and how to manage those from your operation. So the first thing that I would recommend is, let me just start by saying antigen testing continues to be the preferred method for either routine testing if you're in skilled nursing or return to work, testing to meet that particular guidance we just talked about. So that those point of care tests are still the preferred method. I have a couple of recommendations for you guys to follow to help manage this situation. And I'm going to start by saying that we do not have any idea how long it is going to take for the state hygienic lab to replenish their supply and be able to continue providing those to you guys across the state. We know that there, like I said, lots of conversation being had about, you know, how we can help that. But in the interim, these are my recommendations. So for those of you that are testing in your organizations, or all of you that are testing, use your supplies judiciously. And what I mean by that is, yes, meet the requirements for testing, but do not use your tests, just use them very, very sparingly. Do not use them if you don't need to. Do not be handing them out to your staff to take home and test their families. Use them only when required. When or if you are getting low, and I've heard from many, many of you that are already in this situation, my first call would be to your county emergency management authority, or whoever is in your county responsible for emergency management. Some of them have testing supplies available that they can help you. So that should be your first call. The second thing I would recommend is for if you have those Abbott MyNextNow test kits, that you refer to the expiration date extension memo that was posted, and that's going to be in the chat here in just a moment when Brandon gets it there. But there's a document that Abbott, the manufacturer of these particular test kits, published and said, hey, these test kits can be used past their expiration date. But I will caution you, it is based on the lot number of the test kits that you have. So look very closely for the lot number that you have to ensure that it is on the list before you use those test kits past their expiration. The other recommendation that I have is to partner up with your local or your surrounding facilities or providers to see if they have a stockpile of them. I know that at one point in time, there were facilities across the state that were not using many test supplies and had more than enough. And in fact, we had some at that point months ago, donate some for us to dole out to other facilities that were in need. So if you are a facility or a provider that has excess supplies, please reach out if you're willing to share those. And if you are in need, it probably wouldn't hurt to call your neighbors. So for those of you in nursing facilities, you will recall at the beginning of last year that the federal government sent you a testing machine. There were two kinds of those that were sent out to nursing facilities across the nation. If you happen to have those, there are still medical suppliers that have the test cartridges or supplies to use those machines. So reach out to your suppliers to see if they have any of those available. And you may also need to use a system that you're not accustomed to using. So for those of you that are experiencing these severe shortages, reach out to your medical suppliers and see what options they may have. I did hear yesterday that there was an additional testing system that I was not familiar with that they will provide you with a free machine if you purchase so many test kits. So please reach out to your medical suppliers and have conversations with them about what the options are. I'm aware that some of those come with a cost. And, Iowa Healthcare Association has been working really closely with our state and federal government to find ways to provide relief to all of you and to help offset some of these costs. But in the meantime, those are the recommendations to, secure test kits. If you find yourself in a situation where you cannot find antigen testing kits, please ensure that you are documenting all of your efforts to find them, to secure some type of supply. Keep those emails, document phone calls, all of those things. Keep documentation just in case you find yourself in a situation where you have none. And if you do find yourself in a situation where you have no antigen testing kits, the State Hygienic Lab has indicated that they have ample supply of PCR testing kits that they will send to providers across the state. So I know that PCR testing is by far not the best solution to this problem. It creates, some timing issues and just logistics of using PCR testing can be painful. So please make sure that first of all, you're trying to secure your antigen testing kits. And if you cannot, that PCR testing option is always available from the State Hygienic Lab. We are working with DIA to better understand their expectations on how, the rules may apply when using PCR testing. Because those PCR tests will likely pick up a positive many weeks, perhaps after a person has been positive. And so, we're well aware that this may you know, worsen staffing issues, it's going to create some other issues. So we're working with DIA at this point in time. I do not have answers to give in regards to that, but as soon as we have some answers, we will most certainly share those with you. So the next item on the agenda is the therapeutics utilization. Unfortunately, therapeutics are in extremely short supply, and I know that you all are very well aware of this. Any of you who have been using monoclonal antibodies or any of the oral antivirals that are similar to like Tamiflu that's used for influenza, those orals that just came out on the market are in very, very short supply. So let's talk a little bit about monoclonal antibodies first. There are three types of those available and authorized for use. They have found that two of the three are ineffective in treating Omicron. And so they're essentially just nullifying their availability. There is only that, you know, of course, leaves only one available monoclonal antibody that has a very, very limited supply coming into Iowa. But please work with your pharmacy to see if you have a need for those. If you can obtain them, it is not likely that many providers are going to have access to those treatments. There is a pre-exposure prophylaxis option, but that is really not available to our members. They're reserving all of those supplies to be sent to cancer centers across the state for those particular patients who are most in need. And then as I alluded to, those oral antivirals similar to Tamiflu, there are two of them. One that is manufactured by Merck, the other one by Pfizer. They do have some very specific eligibility requirements. So work with your providers to ensure that your patient or your resident, whoever you're caring for, meets those eligibility requirements. And if they do determine that they could use a prescription, we also cannot guarantee that there is going to be supply of those for some time. The very small supply of those oral antivirals went into our retail pharmacies, particularly Hy-Vee. So if you work with a Hy-Vee, there is a chance that you could obtain some of those, but again, not likely. So also one of those things that we're working very closely with our partners over at IDPH to manage, to get those out to our member folks. So with that, I'm going to take a breath and I'm going to let Julie talk. Oh, wait, before I do that, I'm going to talk about the federal public health emergency, what the status is on the federal public health emergency. So for those of you that are following this, I know I have it on my calendar that the federal public health emergency is scheduled to expire on the 16th. That does not mean that it is going to. But ACA did send a letter to HHS over the weekend urging them to extend the federal public health emergency another 90 days. Obviously, they're highlighting all of the things that are happening in our nation in response to this particular Omicron surge in terms of staffing shortages and how this is affecting our operations across the nation. So they did urge HHS to extend the public health emergency for another 90 days. There has not been any word on what they intend to do with that, but we are fairly confident. We are pretty confident that they are going to extend it another 90 days, but we will certainly keep you apprised of the information that comes regarding that. So I'll just answer a question I saw come into the chat very early on about TNAs. And the TNAs are in Iowa we are allowed to continue using TNAs in Iowa so long as the federal public health emergency is in place. And that is through an exception to policy that Iowa Healthcare Association initiated with DIA and DHS. So that is in our regulatory update summary or regulatory relief summary, I apologize, which is also noted at the bottom of your agenda. You can click on that and find the details. But more to come on the federal public health emergency. And again, we're pretty confident that they are going to extend it another 90 days at this time. And they also have committed to giving us a 60-day notice prior to their end of the public health emergency. And we have not heard that 60-day notice yet. So more to come on that. And with that, I'm going to turn it over now to Julie. She's going to talk about what the governor's proclamation said this week.
Thanks, Brenda. Can you hear me okay?
Sure can.
Okay, good. So Governor Reynolds did sign a new public health disaster proclamation on Friday, January 7th. It did extend some regulatory relief for an additional 30 days, which is now through February 6th. Our understanding with this new proclamation is that all the sections are not expected to be extended beyond this February 6th. So she does have an end date for every section in this new proclamation ending it February 6th. And so I want to just give you a quick four bullet synopsis of what fell under the regulatory relief for the healthcare systems that will be ending on that February 6th date. The first one was requiring an institutional health facility to obtain a certificate of need prior to operating additional bed capacity or to changing the type of institutional health facility or institutional health services offered. The regulatory provision of any statute or administrative rule that impedes the implementation of federal waiver issued by the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services and Centers for CMS pursuant to the Section 1135 of the Social Security Act. Within this one, it is within this section that Iowa is able to provide telehealth services to Medicaid population. While we are currently working with state agencies to continue allowing telehealth services for the Medicaid population we serve, the ending of this section on February 6th would end our ability to provide these services through telehealth for Medicaid. So you'll want to be sure you have that date on your calendar. The last two bullet points, the regulatory provisions of the Iowa Administrative Code requiring a residential care facility screen and test and employ for tuberculosis. And the regulatory provision of Iowa Administrative Code requiring a person administering medications in a residential care facility, an intermediate care facility to the intellectually disabled to complete a department-approved Medicaid course and pass a department-approved exam. Up until now, they were able to do just the medication manager course versus AIDS. So that will be going back to the Medicaid course. And again, I just want to reiterate the temporary nurse aid program will remain intact as IHCA has sought and received waivers to allow this program to run alongside the federal public health emergency. So as soon as we see an update from the federal side of things, expect another article to go out regarding the dates for that. Now I'm going to turn it back to Brenda for quality improvement section.
Thanks, Julie. I just want to say in tandem with what Julie just talked about with the governor's proclamation that we expected the governor to end some of what was in her proclamation soon. So that should not come as a surprise really to any of you all. It does not come as a surprise to any of us. To our knowledge, we don't have a lot of members that are operating under many of those state-specific waivers. But if you are one of them and you are, you know, finding yourself in a bind because, you know, something that affects you will be ending in February, please reach out to us and let us know about that. And we will help you navigate through that. So the next thing I want to talk about is the governor's quality award. The DIA submitted or published rather the call for nominations for the Governor's Quality Award at the end of December. And so this is an award that is given to nursing facilities, residential care facilities, ICFs, NIFMEs, and ICFIDs that are nominated by either residents or family members or community members to DIA to receive this award. So there is, it's a nomination process. There is a form that is found on the DIA website. Your families or residents can also find or can also call DIA and request that nomination form. Those must be postmarked and back to DIA by March 1st. There is also an option to complete the form online. And I will actually send out a bulletin article with that information, with those links for that particular nomination form. So if you're in a nursing facility and you have residents and family members that would like to nominate you for this particular award, please let them know that this is available to them until March 1st. So encourage you to do that. In addition to that, those of you that are submitting an application to the National Quality Award through ACA NCAL, that deadline is quickly approaching. Also January 27th. So all of you should have January 27th highlighted on your calendar for several reasons. One of those being that your application to the Quality Award program is due. So for those of you that are submitting applications and have questions about that, please let me know. And as one last push for that, there is a free workshop happening tomorrow for anyone in a nursing facility or an assisted living building program that would like to submit their bronze application. There is still time if you would like to register for that workshop, which is starting tomorrow morning at, I believe, 8 a.m. There's a bulletin article and some information on our website if you're interested in that. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Brandon. He's going to talk about some legislative updates.
Thanks, Brenda. You know, as everyone probably is aware, the legislative session started yesterday morning for the first day. And as far as kind of what we're working on, what we're looking to do in the coming weeks is we are having meetings with the House and Senate leadership starting today, actually, to lay out some more of our priorities for this upcoming session. So we're going to have some of those discussions with them to explain, you know, what we're shooting for and what we're trying to accomplish during this session. I will also be meeting with relevant committee chairs who likely run bills or have bills that impact you all. And so we'll be meeting with them to make sure that they're understanding of our issues and making sure that they, you know and understand what we're trying to accomplish as well. And then other department heads, we're making sure that they're also on board and understanding what we're trying to accomplish. And so if you're looking for our legislative update, we do have that posted on our website under the legislative section, I think is what it's where it's under, or advocacy, I think is maybe what it's actually under. But I'd encourage you to look at our agenda for the upcoming year. That's posted on the website, and that's what we're going to be talking about. As we go throughout the session, we'll obviously if there are instances and times where we need to engage membership, we'll be making sure that we'll send out call to actions to you all to participate and help us advance some of those topics. And then as we're flipping through and going through, we look at every single bill that is submitted by every legislature, and we're looking to check on if there are any impacts to you all. And so we will be posting in our bulletin weekly an update of bills impacting members. And so we'll put our own little synopsis and understanding of how that would or would not impact you all. And we try to be pretty expansive with that list. And so even if it has a minor impact, we like to include that in that list as well. So more to come, obviously. Day two of the session today. It's a long process, runs through the next several months, and we'll be continuing to advocate for the best interests of you all at that time. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Lori, who's going to be giving an update on our workforce survey.
Thanks, Brandon. We know one of the top priorities you all have right now that you're all facing out there is just the challenges with workforce and the whole workforce environment. So as we are working through this legislative session and just actually throughout the whole year as part of our strategic planning at the association, we are focused on doing all that we can to help you with workforce issues. In order to do that, we need more feedback from you on specifics on what you're seeing out there in the field when it comes to workforce. So we are currently conducting a workforce survey. And like I mentioned, the purpose of the survey is to help inform us with the top issues and more specifics on what you're facing to help us with legislative and regulatory strategies to address those needs. This survey was emailed to all facility administrators December 13th and again on January 5th. We just need one per facility, so we sent them to the facility administrators. If you are an administrator and received this email with the survey and have not yet taken it, please take a few moments to do so today, and please by no later than end of the day tomorrow so that we can start using that data this legislative session. And if you have any questions about the survey, or if you've deleted the email or need the email resent, please reach out to me and I'd be happy to help you with that. And then I believe next is Julie. She's going to give you an education update.
Thanks, Lori. Yes. So in your invite, you have a link to our 2022 IHCA education events calendar. If you click on that, you'll see everything that's currently up. We do add to that routinely, so we would ask that you check back frequently to our calendar. And for those folks who have activity professionals who need to get in to the course that may have started and were waiting for us to get going with our next round of activity professionals course, that does start January 26th. It is up for registration. So if you have someone that needs that course, please go ahead and get them registered at your convenience. And now we'll turn it back to Brandon for some questions and answers here.
Thanks, Julie. So the question here, is there any possibility of additional rounds of provider relief coming to long-term care from the government? That's a question from Shelley. As of now, we're not aware of any additional rounds of funding. The most recent one would have been the rural distribution and phase four of the provider relief funds, and those would have come out and maybe are still coming out to some providers now for the phase four portion. But as of now, we're currently not aware of any additional rounds of funding for LTC yet. This question is with, and I guess as I'm going through these questions, if I've seen that they were answered further on in the agenda, I'll likely end up skipping those questions. So if you don't have the answer and I passed your question, that's likely why. And so if you didn't get the answer that you thought you needed, if you could put that in there again, that'd be great. With new changes for quarantine, do we start testing those who are positive when they return to work versus waiting to test them 90 days after the positive date? Brenda, many of these will be yours.
So again, like I said, it's very confusing on this these folks who had a positive case and the waiting 90 days. So there really are two answers to the question. The first answer is you would follow the return to work guidance for someone with an exposure, even if they have had an infection in the last 90 days. Once they have returned to work, the guidance for routine testing has not changed. So they could be excluded from routine testing once they return to work.
Thanks, Brenda. Mm-hmm. If OSHA's mandate is off and SCOTUS rules against CMS, can individual employers mandate vaccines in Iowa, or has the state ruled against that like Florida has?
That's a great question. Iowa does not have any law that prohibits an individual employer to establishing an internal vaccine mandate. In fact, there are many entities across the state who have placed an internal mandate, have put a mandate in place for their employees. So that is still allowable.
I think part of what Iowa did during the special session in October was expansion of some unemployment benefits, I think, for those individuals who maybe had an employer who required a vaccine mandate. I think that, if I'm remembering that correctly, Brenda.
Yes, Brandon, thank you for reminding me of that. Yes, there was a rule put into place that said if an employee loses their employment based on their choice not to become vaccinated, they could be eligible for unemployment.
Thanks, Brenda. Yep. Positive staff can still work with positive patients, correct?
Yes, if you are working in crisis capacity, there really is no work restriction for a positive staff. But you would have to establish that you're in crisis mode. So really, you need to follow the guidelines for being in crisis staffing before you can allow positive staff just to return to work. Otherwise, you would follow the other restriction, the contingency or conventional return to work guidelines.
NHSN vaccination entry has changed again to include flu vaccine residents and flu vaccine healthcare workers, and allow submission for the week by leaving it blank and just including COVID data. However, are these now required weekly as well? And we missed the change?
I have not heard of any change in NHSN reporting requirements to include flu vaccine. So if it's there, it's optional, which it likely is if it allows you to submit without that information. But I am not aware of any requirement to report flu vaccination information as a requirement.
Is there any discussion of ceasing testing if vaccination status doesn't matter and if we are in crisis staffing, we can have our staff work with COVID? So why test anymore?
It's a great question. I have not heard of any conversation surrounding the end of COVID testing.
Do we have to have them test on every day 1 to 3 if they are not working all of those days? Say they work on day 3, do they still have to test on day 1 and 2 for an exposure on an unboosted employee if we are in contingency mode? There's a lot of factors there, Brenda. I don't know if you follow.
Yeah, that's a great question. Honestly, I don't know the answer to that, but I would suspect that if they were not working, there would not be a requirement to test them. And I think you can justify that. But I don't know that that's in writing anywhere. So I see Debbie asked that question. Let me do some more research on that. But I would think you would be okay not to test if they're not working that day.
Debbie, it may help to email Brenda since we don't see an email attached to your name or anything like that. They return to work. They return on day 6 after quarantining for 5 full days, correct?
Yes. So when you're counting the days, the day of symptom onset or the day of positive test is day 0. So then you would count 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 from there. So yes, good question.
If staff are wearing masks, it is not a high risk exposure, correct?
I think that there are some variables there. If you have a positive, if you're talking about staff to staff exposure, if they are both wearing masks and following good infection control prevention guidelines, there is a potential that they could be excluded from having a high risk exposure there. Let me get to the actual, go on to the next question and I'll come back to that.
Okay. The next one says, so no 5-day return to work possibility like the CDC said.
So the CDC liked to, you know, per their normal routine, they updated the public, the guidance to the public close in proximity to the time that they updated the return to work guidelines for healthcare personnel, and they are different. So yes, the general public can not quarantine or isolate after 5 days so long as they're wearing a mask, but that does not apply to healthcare personnel.
Would you speak to community exposure of a positive employee? So say employee lives with individual who is positive, employee has no signs and symptoms and is fully vaccinated and boosted. The two are not able to isolate from each other. Do we still use the same return to work guidelines?
Yes, unfortunately we do.
What do you do with staff members who continue to test positive for a long time after the illness?
In terms of return to work?
I would assume so.
Well, if you are in contingency staffing, they can return to work after 5 days with or without a test. So even if they continue to test positive, they can return to work so long as their symptoms are improving or they're asymptomatic. I don't know if that answers the question, but
I think so. I think, okay. You know, what it gets at is, and I know you've talked about it, there's a possibility that they'll continue to test positive if they've had COVID. And mm-hmm. so is this where that 90-day time frame comes in where they don't necessarily need to be testing them?
Yeah, I think there are probably many variables that could, you know, influence the answer to that question. So whoever asked that question, if that is happening, please reach out to me and we'll walk through that together. I want to go back to the question about high risk exposure. So this is what it says on the CDC's guideline. So if a healthcare personnel is not wearing a respirator, or if wearing a face mask, the person with COVID infection was not wearing a face mask. So if one person, the provider was wearing a mask or a respirator and the other person was not, that would qualify as a high risk exposure. Or if the healthcare worker was not wearing eye protection, if the infected person was not wearing a mask, or if the healthcare personnel was not wearing all recommended PPE. So I don't know if that answers the question, but that's what is outlined on the CDC's website. And it's on that return to work guidance link that we sent earlier in the chat.
Perfect. I know this next one is another type of situation, which I think it likely just lays it out. So person tests positive on the 6th. They plan on coming in on the 13th to test. If it is positive, she has to wait until the 16th to return to work, but I do not have to test her again for 90 days from the infection as long as she does not have a high risk exposure. So I think, you know, the date of positive test is the 6th. They come in on the 13th to test again. And if it's positive, they have to wait the full 10 days, correct?
Yes. If you're in conventional staffing pattern, yes, that would be the recommended return to work guidance.
Okay. This question is, we suggest retesting if symptoms recur. However, a test can remain positive for up to 90 days. What would be the reason for retesting? Because they're symptomatic again, or their symptoms haven't improved, Brenda? Or what are your thoughts on that?
Say the question again. I'm sorry. I'm not following along in the chat, so I don't have it in front of me.
No, you're fine. It just says, we suggest retesting if symptoms recur. However, a test can remain positive for up to 90 days. What would be the reason for retesting?
Well, I think you would retest if that person had a high-risk exposure, or if their symptoms worsened. I don't know that I would retest or be concerned if it was, continuation of the original symptoms.
Right. I think, you know, the concern probably here would be, you know, they've already tested positive, that the positive test could be just a recurrence of their previous bout with COVID, and these symptoms could be something different. I suppose, yeah. And you may have like a false positive, I guess is maybe what you'd call it.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a tough situation.
Yeah. In those situations, you may want to work with either your medical director or that person's primary care physician to determine when they should return to work.
Is the guidance still in place that if an employee is symptomatic and has a negative rapid test, that they should be off work and have a PCR test completed?
Well, antigen testing is still the preferred method for return to work, or has been established as the preferred method for return to work testing, simply because PCR tests are much more sensitive than a point of care or an antigen test. And so PCRs are more likely to show positive for a longer duration of time after infection, which would, you know, likely show a false positive, you know, while that person is not contagious or having an active infection.
So do we still recommend testing a symptomatic person, I guess, if with a PCR, if they had an Abbott card that came back as negative?
So if they're symptomatic and the Abbott test was negative, yes, the recommendation would be to confirm that with a PCR.
Okay, perfect.
If that's what I meant, yeah.
Yep. Okay. That's the question, yep.
Yep, okay.
Any idea in the QSO, they list plans for non-vaxxed employees testing weekly, making them wear N95s. Just wondering if we have to do these or what others are doing for non-vaxxed staff.
Well, as with any other guidance, I would do what is suggested as additional measures. And so I would highly suggest that N95s are used for unvaccinated staff. If you're not going to do that, you'll want to seriously consider other measures, like maybe reassigning a person. It's not a requirement, but it is kind of one of those voluntold situations.
We will likely include most of this information, I would think, in the bulletin, don't we, Brenda?
Yes, it's already included in the bulletin. It's ready to go out tomorrow.
Perfect. Abbott hasn't been updated since May. Most of our boxes are not on the list. Do we know when they will send a new list out?
I have not heard that they will be updating any of that extension on the expiration dates.
Here's a home health question. Any recommendation on how to handle testing for private duty home health nursing when employees do not live in close proximity of the office to test on site and would have to get tested elsewhere?
Oh boy. Well, I know that there are testing sites like at pharmacies or other places. I don't know if there would be a cost involved with that and how that might be handled. I do know that there is a recommendation against self-testing and self-reading. So I would not recommend that you send your folks home and have them self-test and self-read those. So I would look for a partner, or, you know, that person may have to drive to the office or wherever you're doing your testing.
This is a response to the Health Alert Network. Someone had tried to subscribe and the person responded saying that it was for public health agencies and hospitals only. Is that something you're aware of at all, Brenda?
No. Would you reach out to me, whoever said that?
We can do that. Do we need to continue to cohort dialysis patients? If the new admit is fully vaccinated and boosted, are they able to share a room with a dialysis patient?
I think it depends on the vaccination status of the dialysis patient. And there's certainly some variables that go into that. There is not a requirement for quarantine of folks that leave the building for less than 24 hours or do so routinely. However, you know, dialysis patients generally are somewhat immunocompromised, so you may want to choose carefully who you room them up with. But certainly a fully vaccinated and boosted person may be one of the best choices.
This one may be for you, Julie. Is the 12-hour of home care aid in service still under the waiver?
It is under the federal waiver, yes.
Perfect. If a staff member is fully vaccinated but not eligible for the booster yet, do they still have to quarantine for a high risk exposure?
Yes.
So if I have an employee test positive, negative on day 7, so they come back to work, will I then wait again the 90 days or continue to test them if we are in outbreak?
So they would be exempt from routine testing. So you would not be required to do the, you know, twice weekly, which is what the standard is in Iowa for the level of community transmission. You would, however, want to test them if they had an exposure. So I know that's complicated, but they would still be exempt from the routine testing. So if you had an outbreak, you would want to determine whether or not that particular person had a, you know, would be on your list if you're doing contact tracing or if you're doing broad-based testing, you would want to include them.
And there's a question about funding disbursement, and we do continue to work at the state level with the governor's office and the Department of Human Services about ways to get additional funding out to providers. Many of it is related to staffing, using some of those funds to help with some of the staffing resources and to help combat some of that, those issues that you're experiencing. And so we're working with them at the state level. We are partnered with American Healthcare Association, who does a lot of the advocacy work with the Biden administration and HRSA to work on ways to get those dollars to be allocated towards the SNF and AL sector. AHCA does that. On the NOC side, they would be the ones advocating for those CARES Act dollars to be dispersed for home health agencies. And so we continue to work with both of those federal partners of ours to work the federal angle on that. So I have a question from Annette here. It says, agencies are all over the board, RE, if they are notifying patients and families when there was a staff member who tested positive and saw the patient within 2 days prior to the positive test. Do we have anything on this that is written or in black and white? Some agencies are notifying all patients and then checking in for 14 days on the patient. Others have continued that practice, have not continued that practice, even a notification to patients and family. What is the current guidance? And it varies by vaccination status. We assume the staff has on routine PPE. That's probably a Julie question. I know you're still on, Julie.
I am on, Brandon. So current guidance would be to alert the patient and family if their loved one has had a direct exposure.
Is that guidance from like the CDC then, Julie, or is that like ICHC, IHCA guidance?
It's not strictly IHCA. I can go back in and hunt it down on our COVID page for you.
Perfect.
Annette, if you want to shoot that to me so I have your email, I can get you the link.
With the number of positive cases occurring, what is the regulation for notification to families and residents for each positive employee? Does the fully vaccinated employee who is not eligible for the booster yet follow the fully vaccinated boosted quarantine or not fully vaccinated section?
So I think we answered the second part of that question already, but the requirement in nursing facility for notification of families and residents is remains the same as it has always been. It's 5 o'clock by the next day. And then after that, weekly of any, you know, updated cases.
I think we only have one more question. Does CMS mandate speak to boost doses for the vax mandate?
No, the CMS interim final rule only includes the primary series, does not require boosters at this point.
Okay. I see a couple other comments just around vaccine or cases and percentages of cases in Iowa. I don't have those numbers in front of me, I know. But I mean, your comments, Wendy, are understood with regards to vaccinated and still receive or still getting COVID. So we definitely understand some of the frustrations that providers have with that, but these are the guidances and the rules that are given and passed down through the CDC and from the federal government to all of us. And we're just kind of relaying the response and the guidance that we get from them to you all. All right. That is the end of our questions. We've reached the end of all those. Appreciate you all joining us again today on our member call. We did run over, obviously, but we had a lot of updated information that ended up actually taking the full hour. And so we wanted to make sure that we got to the questions as best as we could. And so if you end up having more questions or you want to continue to have some discussion or unique situations, feel free to reach out to the staff here at IHCA, and we'll be sure to get you some of those answers. And so hope everyone has a good rest of the week. We will have our regularly scheduled call here. Let me pull that up. So depending on the member group, we do have a home health provider call on Thursday of this week. We have the AL provider call on Friday the 21st. And then we have our next and regularly scheduled IHCA SNF provider call on the 25th. So those are the dates of the upcoming calls, and hope everyone is able to tune in then. Thanks, everyone.